his final state spending plan as governor, Mike DeWine wants to raise taxes in Ohio on sports gambling, cigarettes, and recreational cannabis. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll talk about what the governor wants to do with the revenue those tax increases would generate. We'll also discuss some bills introduced by Kentucky lawmakers that reflect skepticism about public health guidance, and we'll hear how flu season is walloping the region and get tips for how to avoid getting sick. Joining me now to get us started are Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Welcome back, Sarah.
Hey, Lucy. Good to be here.
Great to have you. And Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer. Thanks for being here, Jeremy.
Hey, thanks so much.
Jeremy, Governor DeWine, as I mentioned, introduced his final proposal for the state's main operating budget. It includes a plan to increase the state's sports gambling tax. Tell us about that.
Sure. Governor DeWine, for nearly his entire 50-year career in politics, has been an opponent of things like tobacco use. He's not a fan, certainly, of recreational marijuana. And he finds, he's indicated that sports gaming is a little distasteful, but he's going on the theory that if you can't beat him, tax him. He wants to raise the tax on cigarettes in Ohio to $3.10 a pack. That's a $1.50 a pack increase. He wants to double the marijuana, recreational marijuana tax to 20%, and also double the sports gaming tax to 40%. So then he would take that money and all the stuff he finds distasteful and try to turn a sin into a virtue, if you will, by spending the cigarette tax increase on a $1,000 a year child tax credit for lower and middle income Ohioans. He would use the gambling money, as you said, to fund stadium projects. So the two biggest are, of course, building a new potential Cleveland Browns stadium, as well as major renovations to Paycor down in Cincinnati. And then as for the marijuana tax, that would go to things like county jails, police training, and mental health initiatives.
A lot to talk about there. Sarah, let's stick with the sports gaming tax increase for now. How much money would that increase be expected to generate?
I don't have a number for you, Lucy, and I'm sorry, but I mean, it is a situation where as you increase these taxes, you also, on the flip side, don't always see the same output, particularly with this sports gambling increase. You're increasing the tax on proprietors, so those sports books that operate in Ohio. And I've heard from some in the sports gambling industry, and of course, you know, when DeWine and his agencies are putting together numbers for the budget, they definitely take some of this into account. But I've heard from folks in the sports gambling industry that, you know, certain operators are not going to operate under a 40% tax on their receipts.
Jeremy, what have you heard from sports betting companies and from lawmakers about this idea?
So first, the number I have, you asked about how much this would bring in. And under the governor's budget, it would bring in doubling the sports gaming tax. It would bring in $288 million over the next 2 years. And one thing we have to find out now is, you know, if you're going to build, I know the Browns have been asking for $600 million. So we got to find out, you know, are they going to get it over time, or, you know, where's that going to come from? Especially as, you know, the Bengals are also looking for a nine-figure renovation as well. As for lawmakers, they've been pretty skeptical about this for a couple of reasons. One is DeWine didn't tell a whole lot of people before proposing this. He didn't talk to the Browns. He didn't talk to local officials, you know, including in Hamilton County. This kind of came as kind of out of left field, no pun intended, for a lot of people involved in this issue. So now everyone's kind of looking it over and seeing what they could do, whether they like it. But lawmakers, and especially Republican lawmakers who control the Ohio State House, they are skeptical of any tax increase. They're also, another thing is, as Sarah mentioned, you're both relying on these sin taxes. At the same time, you're trying to, at least in terms of the cigarette tax, intentionally reduce demand for it. So DeWine intentionally wants to raise taxes to get fewer people to smoke. But then when you rely on it to fund these budget priorities, it creates a question of, well, how stable is this going to be, especially if you're trying to undermine it?
Sarah, we talked about how the tax on recreational cannabis would be increased under the governor's plan. What other changes is the governor proposing to the state's recreational cannabis law? There are also changes in terms of where that money would go, right?
Yeah, a big one to watch is changing where that tax revenue flows. And I talked with a township trustee president in Columbia Township in Hamilton County, so not far from Cincinnati. And he's incredibly frustrated because right now, under the law that Ohioans ratified in 2023 on the ballot, issue two, the biggest kind of bucket of tax revenue is 36% of the tax revenue from the recreational marijuana program goes to what's called a host communities fund. So that host communities fund can benefit any community that has a recreational marijuana dispensary in town. So David Kubicki, the president in Columbia Township, he told me that, you know, he wasn't totally sold on the idea of having a dispensary in town. He said he's never smoked marijuana in his life, but he saw this as a benefit to the local economy. You know, their township needs to fund the police force and fund other, you know, social services. So he said he really looked at that as a benefit. They have dispensaries in town now, but the state is looking at redirecting tax revenue to different programs. Like Jeremy said, local jails construction is one of them listed in the governor's budget. But I think that some of where the money goes is still pretty loose because you got to go through the budget process. There's also a bill making its way through the Senate that sends everything to the state's general revenue fund. But issue two put very specific guardrails around where that money goes, and the state is definitely looking to shake it up.
Jeremy, you mentioned the tax credit that's part of the governor's proposed budget, too. Tell us more about that, how much it would be. And you said that money is coming from, would come from the hike in the cigarette tax. Is that correct?
That's correct. So right now already, there's a $2,000 federal child tax credit. This would create the state equivalent of that, but it would be $1,000 per year for parents who have a kid who's 6 years old or younger. And there's other criteria to be, you have to, a married couple who files jointly has to earn less than $94,000 a year. If you're a single parent, it could be up to $69,000 a year. And then the credits would taper down as your income increased. So it would be $1,000 if you are a lower income Ohioan, but if as you near that $94,000 limit or $69,000 limit, it would go down as you make more money.
And explain what the governor wants to do when it comes to funding for K through 12 education, Jeremy.
Well, he wants to implement the final leg of the Cup Patterson school funding formula or proposal, which is basically to increase school funding, K-12 funding by $2 billion. And at the same time, however, he wants to reduce what are called guarantees. That's money given to school districts that see a sudden drop in state revenue. So obviously, many school officials are apprehensive about losing some, and they wouldn't get rid of all guarantees, but some of them. However, it would implement this final leg of school funding. And we should say, be very, very careful that this is just the start of the budget process. It's going to take months, and it almost always happens where lawmakers rip out whole parts of this budget and make it almost unrecognizable in some places. So just because the governor is proposing it now doesn't mean when he signs it, probably in late June, that this or any other proposal is guaranteed to be in there.
Sarah, hasn't the Speaker of the House questioned whether the state should implement the final leg of that school funding plan?
Yeah, he's definitely Speaker Matt Huffman has definitely expressed wanting to look at other venues. He said at a press conference in January that in his estimation, the General Assembly decided on this Fair School funding plan several years ago, and the idea that they would, kind of bind the General Assembly to continuing to fund this. He called it a fantasy, actually. And of course, Huffman is a big proponent of non-public school vouchers that allow parents of K through 12 students to use money to go to a private school. So he wants to see vouchers expanded. He's expressed that before. So I'm sure that's something he's looking to when you're talking about funding K through 12 education in Ohio.
Jeremy, is that one of the reasons you noted that sometimes entire parts of the budget kind of get ripped out during the process?
It sure is. And that's one of the major things that we're going to be looking at to see what they do, because not only can lawmakers take things out, they can put things in. And this budget overall is going to be tighter than it's been in the past few budgets, because the state has gotten billions of dollars in coronavirus relief aid from the federal government. There's been higher than expected tax revenues the past few years, and now we're coming back down to earth. So this isn't like we're in the middle of a depression or anything, but it's a much more quote unquote normal budget, where they only have maybe a couple hundred million dollars to work with that isn't already spoken for, compared to the past couple of budgets when basically they could give everyone what they wanted. Public in the last budget, they drastically increased school vouchers to private schools, but they drastically increased money to public schools too. And now it's not going to be that scenario this time around.
Sarah, I know the governor also had some ideas about higher education funding in this budget proposal and what that, at least some of that funding, should be tied to. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, he wants to really see that higher education funding is tied to graduate outcomes. One of the things that he talked about extending funding for is his governor's scholarship, where the highest 5% of a graduating class in an Ohio high school who choose to attend an Ohio university get a $5,000 per year scholarship. So it's kind of encouraging students in Ohio who are going to high school in Ohio to stay in Ohio and go to Ohio universities, because of course, you've heard talk of kind of a brain drain in Ohio. You've got smart kids who are maybe going to college out of state and not coming back after they go through high school, or they're going to college in Ohio and then they're going elsewhere. So he also says he wants to tie it to outcomes like job placement and job placement within a certain time frame, things like that.
Jeremy, is there any sense for how complicated that would be?
So it's only the governor's proposal for higher ed is for tying that funding to how many recent graduates get jobs is only a, right now at least, a small part of the budget. So Ohio right now gives about $2 billion annually to public universities and colleges, and DeWine wants about a 100 million of that to be tied to whether graduates are employed. Now, the one big question now that we need an answer to is, how do you determine that? I mean, do you just have someone in the governor's office who has a list of recent graduates and a LinkedIn account? I mean, we have to find out exactly how that's going to work. But the governor said this Ohio would be the first state to do this. Right now, I mean, Ohio doles out the money, doles out based on things like number of students completing courses and degrees and things like that. This would be an added metric, and Ohio would be the first state to add that as a metric.
And it's interesting because, I mean, like Jeremy said, it's not only are you going to be watching, the LinkedIn profiles of recent graduates or whatever, but what, I mean, is it in a specific, what if someone graduates in one major and then gets a job in another major? So there's a lot that goes into the statistics that universities track about how successful their students are post-grad. So it's interesting to see how the state will be tracking that.
Sure, there are a lot of college graduates who work in restaurants, for example, for a while until they get a job that maybe was more focused on their major. So that'll be interesting to watch. Jeremy, there was also news this week about a Republican we thought would be running for governor next year. Tell us what happened with State Treasurer Robert Sprigg.
Well, Robert Sprague, who's a Republican from Finley, he's been treasurer since 2018, and he was considered an underdog in what was, until his announcement, going to be a three-person race, a three-man race for the Republican gubernatorial primary in 2026. And Sprague announced he up until pretty recently he said he was going to soon announce for governor. But this week, as you said, he said instead he's going to drop out of the race. He's going out of the governor's race. He's going to run for Secretary of State to succeed, or hopes to succeed, Frank LaRose. And instead, he's going to back Vivek Ramaswamy for governor. This decision, again, Sprague would be was going in as the third person in the three-man race, and it'll leave Ramaswamy, who's probably going to announce later this month, and Attorney General Dave Yost, who announced last month in the governor's race.
I'm glad you clarified that because everybody talks about Ramaswamy as a candidate, but he hasn't really officially announced yet, has he?
Not yet. I mean, based on what I'm hearing, he's going to announce later this month, but he's not technically a candidate yet, so he can't do things like raise money or. He hasn't filed officially yet, but I mean, it would be a major, major shock given everything, especially all the people that he's hired would be very shocked to know that he would not be running for governor. So that's probably coming soon.
Yeah. Do we have any idea why Robert Sprague changed his plans and decided to run for, Secretary of State instead of governor?
He didn't say. My suspicion is, as I said before, he was going in as probably the third person in a three-man race. And in addition, he had also been looking at down ticket, even while he was also looking at governor. So it doesn't come as a complete surprise. He had the least name ID probably of the three of them. And when you have someone like Vivek Ramaswamy, who is nationally known and ran for president, and then you have Dave Yost, who, in addition to being attorney general, was previously auditor, and can also raise a whole lot of money as well. He probably looked at his chances and thought, maybe I should set this one out and instead go for Secretary of State. Right now, there's only two other people running for Secretary of State. One is a Republican, Niraj Antani from the Dayton area. He's a Republican. And then there is Brian Hambly. He is a cancer doctor from Warren County, and he's running as a excuse me, as a Democrat.
So you mentioned Sprague was probably the underdog in the gubernatorial race. If he had decided to pursue that, will he be an underdog in the Secretary of State race?
I mean, we'll have to wait and see. Sprague is probably going in as the favorite, but it's real early. We're about what, 15 months out, and normally people announce for things like governor around the summer in the year before, and so we're kind of running a few months early. And the main reason we're doing that is because John Husted, who was a lieutenant governor until recently, he abandoned his plans to run for governor last month when, of course, DeWine appointed him to the U.S. Senate, and that sort of set off a chain reaction. All these musical chairs got rolling a few months earlier than anticipated.
So, Sarah, Jeremy just talked about how we assume, a candidate in Vivek Ramaswamy for governor. We've got Dave Yost, who's announced. What about on the Democratic ticket? Remind us who has announced for the Democratic primary for governor.
Sure. Well, you've got Amy Acton, the former Ohio Department of Health director. She became well known during the COVID-19 pandemic, of course, because she was working next to Governor Mike DeWine, who's a Republican. So a little bit of bipartisanship there. And, she is really. She and both Brian Hambly, the candidate Jeremy talked about for Democratic Secretary of State, they've both really, I think so far in their campaign material, have relied on this idea of being outsiders. They're doctors, they're not politicians. And so it'll be interesting to see if that's what Democrats as a whole go for in statewide races. Nobody else has declared, but of course, This is going to be a little bit of musical chairs for Republicans, and it's going to be a really tough race for Democrats statewide in 2026, especially after the bruising race that Sherrod Brown lost in 2024. I mean, I think it's hard to convince a Democrat to run statewide right now because you got to raise a lot of money. There's not a lot of Democrats with name ID. Like, Democrats don't have that. They don't even have a front bench right now, really, for a lot of these positions.
Well, lots to watch in Columbus and throughout Ohio. I've been talking with Ohio Public Media, State House News Bureau correspondent Sarah Donaldson, and Cleveland.com politics reporter Jeremy Pelzer. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lucy. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Up next, yes to raw milk and no to fluoride. We'll discuss proposed legislation in Kentucky. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Kentucky lawmakers have introduced several different bills that share something in common: skepticism about long-standing public health guidance. Joining me now to explain all that is Louisville Public Media Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman. Welcome back, Sylvia.
Hello, happy to be here.
Great to have you. So I mentioned there are several bills in the mix this legislative session that reflect this skepticism of current public health guidance. Let's talk first about the bill related to raw milk. What does this proposal seek to do?
Sure. So it essentially seeks to do what, to be fair, several other states have already done and has been in place for a long time, which is to allow the intrastate, so that means within the state, retail sale of raw milk. Currently, Kentucky is pretty restrictive on that. You cannot sell raw milk in retail settings. You also can't sell it on your farm, for example, which some states allow. And it's already federally not allowed across borders. And that's been in place for a long time. But in Kentucky, it's also not allowed in retail settings. And so this bill seeks to change that.
And raw milk, just to make sure we're super clear, that is milk that has not been pasteurized. Is that right?
Exactly. So it's milk that hasn't been heated to that specific amount so that to kill bacteria within it, and is totally raw in that sense.
There you go, right from the cow. So what's the argument against this?
So essentially, it's the same reason why the federal government does not allow it across state borders, which is that when you pasteurize milk, you kill bacteria, you kill various things that could be in the milk from when it, you know, leaves the cow. It collects different bacterium, viruses, things like that. And the pasteurization process typically, and that the scientific argument is that it kills a lot of those different things, and so when you don't pasteurize it, it can carry that those diseases when you drink it. So, for example, right now the big concern is, does bird flu travel through milk, through unpasteurized milk?
Yeah. What's the sponsor's argument in favor of this bill?
Well, he is a member of the kind of liberty wing of the Republican Party, and his argument is that this is about food freedom. People have the right to make their choices about the milk. So whether or not the scientific consensus or scientists say that it's dangerous to drink raw milk, people should have the right to weigh it themselves and drink it if they choose.
And is he not worried about bird flu?
Well, he dismissed those concerns entirely. He said, well, we haven't seen major outbreaks of bird flu through milk yet. I think that that's a little bit of a question mark. The CDC says that they believe there's some evidence that bird flu does travel in raw milk and that they're monitoring that closely. But he dismissed those concerns and says, again, it's people's freedom. They can read the CDC's website as well as anyone else can and make their own determination about whether or not they want to risk their health with raw milk.
And he's not the only elected official who's kind of championed this idea. Hasn't Congressman Thomas Massey been on board with this idea, too?
Yes, he has tried to get rid of the federal ban on interstate sale of raw milk. And then it's also worth noting that Trump's nominee for health secretary, who is still in the middle of the confirmation process in the Senate, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., he is also in favor of raw milk. There are some groups that believe there are health benefits to raw milk, Most of those, if not all of them, have not been held up within scientific circles. But some people claim that it's better with people who are lactose intolerant or asthmatics. Again, that is the science on that is not very conclusive. But there are people who also argue for the health benefits of it.
Let's talk about fluoride next. The CDC has traditionally been in favor of fluoridated drinking water, right?
Yeah, for a long time now. And this is a bill that is not 100% new. In fact, it's not new in Kentucky at all. It's been proposed for, I think, 8 years now, several years at the very least. And fluoride has been controversial for ever since it was first introduced in water in the United States and abroad. And essentially, this bill seeks to make it optional in Kentucky's water sources, so individual communities could decide not to fluoridate their water. Kentucky was pretty early on adoption of fluoridated water. We've had it for a long time here.
And this, I believe this is sponsored by Representative Mark Hart, if I'm remembering correctly. What's his reasoning behind this?
So essentially, it's a pretty similar reason to TJ Roberts's support for raw milk. It's the idea that people, communities should decide whether or not they want fluoride in their water or not. They should be able to make that decision. They should be able to weigh the scientific evidence themselves and make those choices. Also, he calls it an unfunded mandate that local water districts have to pay to fluoridate their water. Kentucky Public Radio has investigated that before, and it's pretty low percentages of different districts' water safety practices. But it is a cost. It is a cost that exists. And essentially, he also compared it to vaccine mandates, saying that fluoridated water is a health practice and that people should be able to choose whether or not they participate in different health initiatives.
And he doesn't seem to be totally sold on its effectiveness. I think he said to you in your story, and he's been on our program before, that if fluoride worked, he wouldn't have a mouthful of cavities, right?
Yeah, that was what he told me, that he himself doesn't remove fluoride from his water. He doesn't filter it out of his water. And so why does he have cavities if fluoride works so well? The CDC and its various research indicates that it decreases cavities by 25%. Obviously, that's not 100%, right? I don't think there's any dentist would agree there's not anything that 100% removes the chance of cavities, right? Especially if you drink sugary drinks and you maybe don't brush with fluoride. Toothpaste, and there's a lot of different things, right, you can do to remove cavities, but it is not 100% foolproof method of removing cavities
There's
or
also a
preventing.
There's also a bill related to WHO directives. What would that do?
Right. So this is also by TJ Roberts, the sponsor behind the raw milk bill. And it's pretty similar, I would say, in spirit to President Trump's executive order beginning the process of removing the country from the World Health Organization's membership. Essentially, what this bill would do, it goes a step further and says that no leadership within the Cabinet for Health and Family Services here in Kentucky can promulgate regulations based on World Health Organization directives. And it actually makes it a felony to do that. That's what the bill would do to promulgate those regulations. I feel like I should note here that the World Health Organization does a lot of things. It, for example, tracks the spread of different diseases, how it crosses borders. It, updates the world on the spread, how those diseases are spreading. What is becoming an issue, what is becoming endemic to different regions. So they do a lot of things beyond, what you might have remembered from the COVID-19 pandemic.
Well, speaking of COVID-19, there's a bill that relates to directed blood donations and COVID-19 vaccines.
Yes. I reported on this bill before I wrote this roundup that we're talking about right now. Essentially, this bill would it does a lot of things. The sponsor has backtracked on a few of the things that the bill would do. It in its current form, it would actually ban anyone who has COVID-19 antibodies or the synthetic mRNA when testing for that becomes available. That's one of the ingredients of the vaccine, the one of the main ingredients of the two federal vaccines. It would basically ban those people from donating blood from their blood being transfused into Kentucky patients. But also, it does it requires that hospitals allow for directed blood donations. And this is a bit of a tricky subject because directed blood donations actually became most common during the AIDS epidemic when there was a lot of, pretty reasonable concerns about the safety of the blood supply. And so people were more willing to or more confident that maybe one of their friends, they knew they didn't have AIDS and they would ask them to give a directed blood donation for them. But now it's become a bit of a thing that people get directed blood donations because they don't trust that the blood that they're getting was from someone who wasn't vaccinated. People are worried about getting blood from someone who's had a COVID vaccine. And scientists say that there's no evidence that someone who's been vaccinated causes any risk to their blood donations. In fact, it means that they have COVID antibodies, which could come with some benefits. And so it's a causes a lot of administrative issues to increase the number of directed blood donations. There's also some risk from directed blood donations that aren't associated with people who are longtime donors, as most blood donors are. And so the FDA actually tells people not to rely on directed blood donations, and this bill would encourage the use of them.
Are all these bills still in early stages of the legislative process?
Yes, they all are. It's unclear if they'll progress, right? I wrote this after the first week of the legislative session. We're now back after a lengthy hiatus. And so, it's a short session this year. It's unclear, really. There are very few bills that have made it very far in the legislative process. We're still in very early days here in Kentucky in this short session. So I'll be tracking them and seeing if they do progress. Really, we don't know if they will. Some of these bills were put forward by the Liberty Caucus, as I mentioned earlier, which is an informal caucus, so more of a group of lawmakers that share a similar ideology, and they are not in the majority in the party, so it's unclear if their bills will make it further.
You mentioned that lawmakers were back this week. There was also a protest at the state capitol in Frankfurt earlier this week. How many people were there, and what were they protesting?
Sure. So this is part of a national protest movement. So there was people at state capitals across the country, and I was involved. I was part of some of the organizer conversations ahead of this protest, and it's really very Kentucky based on some grassroots organizers who just decided to show up at the Capitol on the same day and protest what's been happening federally. They don't agree with some of Trump's executive orders and particularly billionaire Elon Musk's involvement with the Trump administration. And I would say about 200 plus people showed up at the Capitol. Just a lot of people didn't even know if anyone else was going to be there, and they saw it online and decided to show up to protest and to ask for the congressional delegation to step in.
And did you hear any reaction from lawmakers after the protest?
Very little. I would say most lawmakers, they said that they would stick to their ideology. We haven't seen any changes in voting, and we'll just have to keep tracking as protests continue or taper off.
Well, I've been talking with Louisville Public Media Capitol reporter Sylvia Goodman. Thanks so much for your time today, Sylvia. It's always great to talk with you.
Yeah, always great to be here.
Thank you. Up next, flu season is here with a vengeance. We'll hear what the doctor recommends. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Flu season has hit Greater Cincinnati hard. Joining me now to talk about the impact and tips for how to stay healthy are Cincinnati Inquirer health and environment reporter Betsy Kim. Thanks for being here, Betsy.
Thanks for having me.
And WVXU environment reporter Isabel Nisley. Welcome back, Isabel.
Thanks, Lucy.
Betsy, how bad is the flu this year?
So flu activity in Ohio is very high, as well as Northern Kentucky. According to the Ohio Department of Health, 273 people in Hamilton County have been hospitalized for the flu so far this season. It is worse than it was last year, but it's important to keep in mind that we're heading back to the levels that we saw pre-pandemic around 2018 and 2019. So if everyone you know is getting sick and it feels worse, it is worse, but they're not so different from pre-pandemic numbers. That's because of the extended period of social distancing, decreased vaccination. Everyone's immunity is just a little bit lower than it used to be.
And Betsy, how many local schools have ended up closing as a result of so much flu?
Yep. So in the past 2 weeks, it was at least 16. This is across Butler County, Adams County, and a couple of schools in Northern Kentucky as well that closed their doors. Administrators I spoke to said it was mainly the flu, but also the stomach bug, also known as norovirus, that's been making the rounds among students. And with respiratory illnesses usually peaking during the fall and winter, I wouldn't be surprised if there weren't some students with COVID and RSV as well.
Sure. Kids are germy, germy little people. Isabel, what impact has this had on local hospitals with all those people who are being hospitalized for flu?
Yeah, certainly. This, like Betsy said, more people are being hospitalized for the flu this year than have been in the years past. And that's putting some strain on local hospitals, right? Emergency rooms are seeing more people than usual. And I talked with Tiffany Mattingly, who's with the Health Collaborative, and she says this means people are having to wait longer to be seen in the ER.
And she said, don't just automatically go to the ER if you think you have the flu, right? What kind of advice did she have to kind of ease up on hospitals?
Yeah, absolutely. She says, if your symptoms are severe, you should probably go to the emergency room, right? That's symptoms like having trouble breathing, if you're having chest pain, if you're feeling really lethargic or not able to hold down fluids, that probably calls for a visit to the ER. But if your situation is less severe, maybe you just kind of think you have the flu, you have body aches, you have a low-grade fever, you should consider other options. So that might look like scheduling an appointment with your primary care provider or even stopping by in urgent care. And she said if you were going to go to the ER just to get tested for the flu to kind of confirm your suspicions, consider taking an over-the-counter flu test, which is much less expensive and also requires less wait time than a visit to the ER would.
Yeah, and it's amazing they have those now.
Right.
I didn't think we'd ever have an over-the-counter flu test. Betsy, you kind of referenced flu vaccines. Are fewer people getting flu shots? Is that contributing to the problem here?
I don't have year-by-year data. The most recent data that I have for this flu season, which begins around October of every year, is that as of the beginning of November, 33% of adults in Ohio had gotten the flu shot. This is according to preliminary numbers from the CDC. This sounds low, and I'm sure doctors would love for that number to be higher. But estimates of herd immunity, the threshold for influenza, do tend to be lower than they are for other vaccine-preventable illnesses. For measles, by comparison, it's 95% of the population that needs to be vaccinated to achieve that herd immunity. For flu, I've seen estimates that range from 33 to 73%. It's very dependent on whatever strains of the influenza virus, which mutates really frequently, are circulating at the time and how effective the vaccine is. But we do know that getting the flu vaccine does lower your risk of being hospitalized for the flu by around 40%, according to some studies.
Okay, so sort of like the COVID vaccine, it won't necessarily prevent you from getting it, but if you get it, it shouldn't be as serious. Is that the idea?
That's right. Your symptoms will be less severe.
Okay. Isabel, is it too late to get a flu shot? Can you still, if you're listening to this thinking, oh, I had that on my list and I just never did it, can you still get one?
Absolutely. It is not too late to get a flu shot at all. Although local health experts are saying that this might be the peak of flu season, it's certainly not the end of it. It often lasts through March and even later, maybe even till May. So not too late to get a flu shot.
Oh, man, till May. That doesn't sound good. So I want to ask both of you, I'll start with you, Isabel. What are doctors recommending if you're feeling sick? Like, what should you do? What shouldn't you do?
Absolutely. If you're feeling sick, you should stay home. It can be hard to kind of balance work, school, life, all that. But respiratory illnesses like the flu, like COVID, they're transmitted from person to person and, you know, through those droplets that are infected. And it can also spread through contact with contaminated surfaces. Jennifer Mooney with the Northern Kentucky Health Department says, even if you're feeling sick but not too sick, it's really important to kind of contain yourself from other people, because even if the illness isn't too severe in you, there are other people all around us us who are more immunocompromised or might just have a much more severe reaction to the illness than you are. And she also suggests taking preventative measures. If you're not sick right now, there are several illnesses going around, like Betsy said. So one of the easiest things you can do is wash your hands a little bit more, you know, 20 seconds using soap and water, you know the drill. And this is also helpful from protecting yourself from the stomach bug, where hand sanitizer is not effective in protecting you from norovirus. And kind of final thing, you know, you can put a mask on, cover your coughs and sanitize hard surfaces. And like I said earlier, it's still not too late to get a flu shot. So that's one of the biggest things you can do.
Yeah. Betsy, what are you hearing from people about, okay, like what about a sick kid or a kid? Kids get sick so much. My daughters are grown now, but they always have some kind of sniffle or little bitty cough. What should parents be looking for to decide whether they keep their children home from school?
Yeah, I talked to Dr. John LeCount, who is a pediatrician with St. Elizabeth in Florence, Kentucky. He also says it's not too late for you or your kids to get the flu shot. It's really easy to look up the pharmacy near you at vaccines.gov. And if you're nervous about your kid getting sick from other kids at school, he also recommends masking to reduce the transmission of potentially infectious droplets. And it's also a good time, I think, to draw attention to urgent care centers. If you are feeling not so great and you want medical attention, but you know it doesn't rise to the level of an ER and you want to avoid those wait times that we're seeing at our local hospitals, you can always visit urgent care centers, which tend to be open after hours as well and can treat minor illnesses and injuries.
Did you hear any other tips, Betsy, from doctors about just staying healthy, what you can do, how to keep yourself healthy, your kids healthy, your family healthy?
Drinking lots of fluids, eating well. Those are important, I would say. And yeah, I would say that pretty much sums it up.
Yeah, that hand washing, that's a big one. That's a big one. Well, what, so how sick are people at the Inquirer, Betsy? You got a lot of sick people there?
I've been sick twice the past month have been staying quite a bit. And I would say the newsroom is generally fine. It's, you know, a lot of people in my personal life, I feel, are sick. This is from New York City to California. So I definitely am feeling the national increase in flu cases and seeing it in my own life.
Yeah. Well, you've been covering another kind of flu too, Isabel. I don't mean to spring this on you, but you've been covering bird flu. What are you hearing about that in terms of what the Ohio Department of Agriculture has said about bird flu in our region, egg shortages, all the things that's bringing with it?
Yeah, certainly. So, well, influenza is having a pretty severe impact on humans. Birds are being impacted by another infectious disease called avian influenza. And the Ohio Department of Natural Resources has detected it in several counties. I think 10 is what they're suspecting right now. And also, as we've heard in a lot of commercial poultry flocks, and just recently, the Kentucky Department of Natural Resources found a case in Kenton County in waterfowl there. So it's kind of slowly getting closer and closer to the greater Cincinnati area. And while that is a big concern for birds and poultry, for people, it's not as much of a concern. You know, good hand washing, not touching dead birds if you see them, and obviously reporting them to Department of Natural Resources if you're seeing a lot.
Yeah. Betsy, have you been doing any bird flu reporting?
I have. A few weeks ago, there was a poultry farm. I'm forgetting sort of which county it was, but that had to put down around 1 million chickens. Bird flu is not something that you can cure birds of. So they do need to be euthanized immediately to prevent spread. So that is a story that I did write. That's rather grim earlier in January. I was kind of struck by a study that I came across that said that bird flu is not yet contagious among humans. So if one human gets bird flu, they can't yet pass it to someone else. But this study said that we're really only one mutation away from that. So it's definitely something to keep an eye on.
Yeah. And I believe that flock, that million bird birds that had to be euthanized, that was in Dark County, I believe, in Ohio. So
that's right.
Yes, yes. Well, so Isabel, right now, bird flu can't be transmitted from person to person. That's good news, but we're only one mutation away. That's not great news. You mentioned not touching dead birds, reporting them. Are there any other tips for people? I mean, you can still drink pasteurized milk and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The rules of food safety still kind of apply. You know, drink pasteurized milk. If you're having an egg, cook it all the way through. If you're having chicken, cook it all the way through. And things like that. I know the Cincinnati Edition covered some tips for pets as well, I believe, on what you can do.
Yes, we sure did.
And if you're in a situation where there's a dead bird in your yard or on the sidewalk where you need to kind of address it directly, you're not going to want to touch that with your bare hands. You're going to want to put on gloves if you have to handle it. You're going to want to use a kind of picker up or some sort of scoop, things like that. So.
Great tips. Well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer health and environment reporter Betsy Kim and WVXU environment reporter Isabel Nisley. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Good to be here.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you have a great weekend.